This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hello and welcome to The Ruck, our weekly podcast from The Times and Sunday Times. Today we have a stellar cast of internationals with us and one or two things to talk about from a dramatic weekend. Was it a try or not? Why didn't England take the points in the second half? What does a win over Australia mean for Wales? Can Ireland beat the All Blacks? All those questions and more to be answered by Paul Grayson. Hello, Paul.
Alex, hi.
By Stuart Barnes.
Alex, hi.
And on his Ruck debut, by Dan Lyle, the former Bath and USA number 8, who's now at the vanguard of rugby broadcasting in America. Does that sound fair enough?
We'll see well.
Welcome, everybody. England 15, New Zealand 16. One or two talking points, Stuart?
Yeah, what goes around comes around, doesn't it? I think England were incredibly lucky against South Africa not to be penalised and give Pollard a chance to win the game. When I was commentating there, as you watched it live, it was very hard to see a clear and obvious penalty against Courtney Laws for offside. The officials have been told it has to be clear and obvious before they come in. Therefore, even when we go to the detail, was it offside or not, one has to say that it looks like the laws have been interpreted very loosely by Marius Jonker, and that deprived Sam Underhill, who was best Bath back row forward I've seen since Dan Lyle, sidestepping left and right to bamboozle Bowden Barrett. It would have been a dream finish for him. He had a great game. It was tough on England, but you know, they lost the game, but they won a lot of self-respect, and I think they're back on track now.
Paul, last week a lot was made about the Owen Farrell tackle at the end of the South Africa game, but I think everyone understood that the box had enough chances to win that match. It didn't come down to that one decision. How did you see the game unfolding for England? Because that was a key decision at the end, but they did have chances to win.
Yeah, they did, and actually the two penalties, as Barnsley said, they were lucky to get away with a win against South Africa. But the fact that they did get away with that win bought them the breathing space of a clean record. So you weren't looking back and counting up the amount of tests that England have lost, and you know the third test in South Africa changed their team, and no one was talking about that. They were just England had a free hit against the All Blacks, which takes pressure off completely. So having won that game on a chancy call to end up losing the next one, I think England's performance was aided by the fact that they dodged a bullet against South Africa. In terms of the back end of the game and how tight it was, I was sat next to Matt Dawson in commentary on the game, and he was unequivocal once England had gone for the corner and then got another penalty. He was unequivocal because he was absolutely right. 5 points in the rain, even though you're playing against the best attacking team in the world, five points in the rain is, they've got to score a try. There's no easy out. There is no drop goal to win it. Once they've made that choice and not converted, then you're at the mercy of the gods, aren't you?
Dan, let's deal with the Courtney Laws thing, the offside decision first, and then I think it'd be really good to look into England's performance in a bit more depth. Even now, we're talking Monday lunchtime. everyone is still debating whether or not it was offside. Does that show that A, the TMO was wrong to overturn the decision because there's nothing clear and obvious? And I will just add that I also think the TMO breached the new protocol because he wasn't permitted to make that decision. It had to come from the referee. What's your view on the whole debate and whether or not it was offside or not, whether or not there was enough to overturn the call?
You take a step back and realise that the ruck is the indistinguishable mark that makes rugby rugby. Otherwise, you'd be playing American football or rugby league, right? And the whistle, you know, is open to that. I think that the referees are in a constant flow of what their directives are, what they're supposed to do, what they're not supposed to do. And I think that oftentimes a TMO and a referee and an assistant referee are kind of have each other's backs, you know, are kind of and the communication system sometimes works against them. You know, where, hey, well, just check this or just think about this or, hey, you know, there might have been something there, right? And I think that that takes away. And so some sort of a directive of a protocol of how and when. But I take Stuart's point, probably I hate to say this, at the highest mark here, where in a sense that there was probably enough reason to give it and enough reason not to give it. That means it's probably in American baseball is the runner gets the tie, right? Versus so
yeah.
I would kind of let the advantage of that play itself out. And if you have to call yourself back and say I'm not 1,000% sure, you know, then it's like give me a reason not to award the try.
Yeah,
you
know what I mean? Cricket have the umpire's call, so yeah. It goes to the third umpire, and if the TV footage isn't conclusive, it goes back to the on-field decision.
Dan talked about it. I really interesting officials looking after each other's back, and you know, referee makes a call and his mate buys him time. Now that takes you all the way back to that third test with the Lions when Romain Poit made the absolute right call. Ken Owens was undoubtedly in a deliberately offside position. He knew it. He dropped the ball like a kid who'd been caught with sweets. He gave a penalty. And I think it was Saturday's referee, his mate Jerome Garces, who said you need to see whether Kieran Reid there has been interference in the air. And that enabled him to pause. His instinct was absolutely right, but this is the biggest call of his career. And he paused and he wondered and ended up coming up with the wrong decision. And it was the wrong decision for all the right reasons. Garces wanted to help his mate have the time to make it right.
Having said that, Paul's got the best point of here and so forth. I hate saying it between two tens, you know. I mean, it's, you know,
yeah.
We decide who wins games in the forwards. But at the end of the day, how you determine a win and a loss comes down to multiple moments, multiple moments throughout the game, and the, you know, taking the points, you know, versus, you know, coming to that moment would have, you know, probably I think of the point of saying 3 points in the wet is better than 5 points that it's a 50%. So,
yeah.
You know, I think that there's multiple moments. And so the tackle with Farrell and the offsides by Laws, whether that's the rugby gods or the yin and the yang of the things, you're looking at the overall picture. And because this was a, quote, friendly, even though it was 4 years in the making,
yeah.
You know, England would have said to themselves, we are extremely satisfied, beyond satisfied, that we were able to go 15 points up and have a game that we can play off of, you know, just under a year out from the World Cup.
And the only
final.
The only downside of it for me is that Sam Underhill's try won't be constantly replayed as the try that forget the result. It's a non-try because it's after because they've wound time back and said that no longer exists. One of the best bit of instinctive footwork and worst bit. Barrett's so good.
He's brilliant, like, covering.
I'm so fast I can turn my back and I'll still catch you up. Underhill did him so well that he managed to score from that far out. So the only downside to it, I 100% accept the result that New Zealand should have won the game and did enough to win the game. The only disappointment is that try does no longer exist because it was a magical moment.
And he was picked and largely seen as a defensive open side flanker. His role for England up until that game had been to put in big tackles. He was seen as a different style of open side, slightly to Tom Curry, who had a reputation as more of a link man, a bit more attacking. He completely changed that perception on Saturday.
But they're two babies, you know.
22, what are they? 21.
To pigeonhole a 20-year-old and a 22-year-old as that's what he's good at. when they're at the start of their rugby journeys, they're good enough to play international rugby because they've got a point of difference. Sam Underhill's is that he chops down trees like nobody else we've got. And he was doing it when he was 18. And you think he will fall apart, but he's not. His technique is so good. Now, can he graft on a running game onto it? Well, there you go. He just did it against the best team in the world.
Well, you know, he's got Richard Hill as a mentor. And when he was sort of, I said in the paper today, lumbering towards the line, Hilly used to do that. He lumbered and you didn't think he's quick, but he covered ground. And Underhill did that. And I thought it was very significant long term for England because there was a question. He did look like a very mechanical player. You look at his body for I've seen him play in Pro 12 rugby for a long time. You just think, God, you're very big for someone that age. You've just been turned into a chop monster. And what he did Saturday, it wasn't just the fact that he made so many tackles. The quality of them was exceptional. And I'm sure Dan will pick up. The tyranny of stats, it tells you, you know, which back row forwards, and it's often back row forwards have made the tackles. But you can make a lot of tackles and have very little impact. If you tackle like he did, making 24 tackles with that impact, driving the man back. Dan talked about winning games, lots of myriad bits and pieces. That is one of the key ones, Dan, surely.
He's a 6 and a 7 now. You know, and I think that's what Richard Hill was. And I take the balance of a back row or the balance of the back five to be one of the most important parts of the game. When we talk about New Zealand and Ireland later, is the back five of Ireland solidified, you know, in the scrum and to be able to play kind of that link game that they want to play. But to the point of Underhill and Curry, you know, it's very, very hard to teach graft, breakdown work, great tackle technique. Mm. You know, yes, ball in hand is a special skill as well, as you're saying, Paul, but man, you know, I want a balanced back row that can take me forward. England's biggest weakness was the breakdown, you know, coming into all of last year, all the Six Nations.
It has been for years, Dan.
Exactly.
For
so years. The breakdown. And to see a guy like that, Curry and him being balanced through, would you rather have them on the field than two runs by Nathan Hughes, you know, and one big tackle? Probably on the balance of it. Not to diminish Nathan Hughes, but, you know, the you've got to be a multiple trick pony, you know, in this game to balance yourself out. And then the constant selection from here on out to give them that many more moments is ultimately where this England's balance will, for me, in the long term.
What about the All Blacks, Stuart? I mean, they were 15-0 down. England didn't score a point in the last, 50 minutes, 60 minutes of the game?
There's two New Zealands. There's the all singing, all dancing one when they're on top and they win the gain line and they beat you by 50 points because they have a back three that are quite wonderful, and they've got Bowden Barrett and Aaron Smith who, when they're on the front foot, they change the pace of the game with their vision and you can't handle them. Then there's the other one, and they're vulnerable. South Africa showed it, especially in Pretoria. Because they have so much pace and so much vision, they do sacrifice size to a certain extent. And you can take them in the collision. And you know, England for 25 minutes won every collision. A little bit like 2014. They did the same when Marlon Yard ran over Richie McCaw. England had them on the ropes then. But the other New Zealand is the one that when they're 15-0 down or they're 32-14, whatever it was in Pretoria, like no other team, they say, how do we fix it? And I watched Brodie Retallick, who I regard as the most complete rugby player on the planet, just shift. And there's talk about, oh, were they illegal? Did they step in? Did they do this? It doesn't matter because the referee didn't ping them. He got himself in a position to absolutely destroy the link between the Saracens, Jamie George, and Maro Itoje. And everyone's saying, why did they go George Itoje? I tell you why, because it was biblical the way the rain came down. And you got two guys, champion team, hooker and second row, who know each other. They think, let's go for the safe ball. We can drive that. Retallick said, I'm not doing that. He pulled the rug out from beneath the feet. And when the weather is like that, if you don't get good, solid set-piece ball, you're in trouble. The scrum was under pressure. They got to the line out. The game turned.
That New Zealand, who when they're under pressure and they get their strategies right to get themselves back into the game. I read Ben Kay's line-out synopsis this morning, and Ben's a little
bit
like,
did you understand it?
not really. It's just it's tall men trying to catch a ball.
Yeah.
And he was saying that there's bad calls by the ref and Retallick jumped across the line out, blah, blah, blah. Well, if you run through that second half, go to every offensive breakdown the All Blacks had, there's an England player cleared way beyond the ruck on his back with an All Black on top of him. Every time England carry the ball and get a latch on, there's an All Black tackles the latcher, doesn't tackle the ball carrier, and wipes him out, and you start to lose your momentum. And they suddenly gear up in those on the fringes of legality, which get them an advantage. Eventually, Garces penalised. I can't remember who it was, clearing just ridiculously beyond the ruck.
He was probably Barrett on Ashton, I think.
Maybe, and that's so the fly half gets it wrong. The big men get it right all the time, and they just managed to change the dynamic. They also played 5 minutes of note perfect rugby in the absolute chucking down rain, error free, to force themselves up the field and put themselves in a position to get a foothold back into the game. So with the brilliance, there's also that just those shady areas that they're really good at.
I think there's two great equalizers in Test football. One is weather. Two is kind of injuries and selection. And it seems to me that, you know, I'll harp on a 9 and a 10 being selected all the time and gonna create some consistency with the spine of your team and so forth. So it's funny, as comprehensive as New Zealand are, at times they change their team, you know, in different times and so forth, and who's better at what position. And then you add the weather, which can put any front foot team on the back foot in an instant. You know, there was those times. They're such a magnificent and wonderful team that they're usually able to overcome all of those things. And that slight little chink in their armor, which I agree with Stuart on, is that, you know, they have that size quotient, that they may you know, they're going up against some teams that are as physical, and now with England at the breakdown, and then all of a sudden they maybe be an inch taller, 2 inches taller, a stone heavier, and, you know, all of a sudden that over the course of 80 minutes under those conditions can really take its toll.
But is it a concern for England that twice in South Africa and then on Saturday they roared into a big lead and ultimately lost the game?
I went to Johannesburg for the first test. I was talking to one of the Craig Ray, I think it was, 20 minutes into the game, England are all guns blazing, and he just looked at me and went, altitude. And then you watched England wither on the vine. They just ran out of gas, and South Africa played their way back into the game, and then they made the mistake of going back to Durban and coming back. So it showed to me that actually England could pick them apart with the team that they chose, and they ran out of gas. If you're going to win a game against New Zealand, we all call for them to get out of the blocks and put them under scoreboard pressure, which they did. I thought the first try, England's first try, was fantastic, because it was, it wasn't just one out runners. There's a little pop ball from Sinclair, who he did that two or three times. I thought he had one of his best games for England, and they'd clearly got a plan, because when decoys swept back left and took Damian McKenzie out of position, the ball went over to Ashton. That's just well crafted, good analysis, and you know, perfect performance. England had chances to win the game. We're not going to beat New Zealand by 30 points very often. You're going to beat them by one or two. You go to the end of the game, you kick your goal, the game pans out as it is. I know you can't predict that, but England had chances to win it. It was the decision-making towards the end that cost them that opportunity.
I thought one thing that was very interesting, Dylan Hartley came out at 40 minutes. And this is a team that you look at on face value, and you guys hear it on my right and left one no more, that somehow has got to build an overall team leadership dynamic. And so it takes nothing away from Jamie George coming in at hooker. It just is a matter of fact of how are we controlling this game, when it gets a little bit loose, when we're able to pull it in, who's having the words on the field, who's, you know, doing the right thing. There's a little bit of that dynamic, you know, that, you know, which allows you as a team to come out, having not played them and so forth, and live on that adrenaline high, you know, and play them and so forth. But when the game starts to open up and issues have to have, they have somebody, two or three people have to step into that gap.
And that leadership dynamic, it was tactical, right? The change at halftime? Or was Hartley...
He said afterwards there was a thumb, thumb injury.
As broadcasters, you know, we go down to our man on the touchline and we said we need to know what's the situation, and it was unequivocal. Tactical substitution. And I reckon Eddie saw what happened and the way the line-out went to pieces. The decision-maker didn't cut quite right, and he thought, maybe my plan to put Jamie on and give him 40 minutes against the All Blacks backfired, and I'll find a thumb injury.
It was a dubious explanation.
I don't want to put Jamie George under pressure. He's a wonderful player.
No, no, no. I don't think any of us.
But I'm just thinking that the overall, I use that as this example that you're saying, Paul, which is the overall leadership dynamic needs to improve. You know, as much as they need to improve in some of these tactical areas that we're talking
about. Yeah, absolutely. And they're things you want to find out now, not when you're in Japan. And there's suddenly an enormous amount with the co-captaincy. Once you take off one of the co-captains, who's your next in command? And what's their relationship like with Owen Farrell? Because he's then having discussions with himself about kicking goals. Of course, you've got your lieutenants, but more clarity in that perhaps is somewhere England can find an improvement on. And the one thing I wanted to ask you, Barnsley, actually, was in that last period of the game when George Ford comes on and Farrell goes to 12, as much as he's the captain and still the kind of the
10,
how hard is it to influence the game when you're just that little bit further away?
Well, clearly it is harder, but at that moment I still think Owen Farrell's greatest leadership assets are the sort of Henry IV Part 1 Hotspur taking on, you know, Prince Hal. It's the Northern Warrior. It's follow me, guys. He's a leader. And I think that decision-making-wise, you know, I'd take George Ford over him most of the time. I think he's a little bit cooler. And I think when that happens, you need your kicker to do this. But this takes us back, this debate about the final kicker decision-making, it takes us all the way back to the Chris Robshaw period of captaincy. And if you remember, Owen Farrell was one of the lieutenants going up to Robshaw, and the two of them were discussing things, and the only thing they did consistently in that period leading up to the World Cup and then against Wales was get the call wrong. So it's a real problem for England, but it's not just England, it's a global thing. I mean, let's just move 2 hours down the M4. Australia have blown a tight game. All the boys have said, you get bad game, bad weather, you get matches where there aren't going to be tries. You feel that on the pitch, don't you? You know if there are no tries. And if it's going to be low scoring, you take the three. You don't take the 50-55, as Dan said. But the Aussies, they came out and they got it wrong just as badly as England. It is a global epidemic, I think, of bad decision-making.
And interestingly, in the England game, there's two open play drop goals.
Yeah,
I think Bowden had the arm out for the penalty. It was a penalty advantage when he kicked his.
The first of his career.
Yeah, 71 games in. But there was clearly a mindset that 3 points are very valuable. And then when you get it from a static position, and you've got to back the players. They decide that they feel they've got the edge in the mall, then fair enough, have a go. But when the first one doesn't work and you've had, it's almost like referring to the TMO, you've had one look at what could possibly happen. Yeah. Now, if we drop it, our chance is gone. Do you want to take a three? Because you've got another shot from a better place. And you still turn it down, then you're in that position of, in match review, as long as it's highlighted as in a game like that, would you do the same thing in the same situation? Probably not. No problem. Move on.
Well, what was the dynamic the few games ago when New Zealand had 19 opportunities and to kick a drop goal and they didn't?
Yeah,
and they didn't.
Wellington,
right?
Yeah.
You know, that's kind of a weird social consciousness issue where they're you're literally not going to kick this. You know,
it's a cultural thing in New Zealand.
Well, that's what I mean. Go there and so forth. And by the way, Barnsley wouldn't even know who the outside center, the first center is. You know, outside of him, he knows his right foot and his left foot by name, but probably not the center outside of him.
I didn't even know I had a left foot.
It's like who's that? Who's that guy out there? Oh, look, there's a whole bunch of them outside me.
What the hell is a left foot, Grace? Do you know?
No, it's you for standing on.
The All Blacks are now in Dublin. England are preparing to play Japan. Steve Hansen was saying, well, it's world number one v world number two, a year out from the World Cup. It couldn't get more tasty. Who's going to win?
The problem is, when New Zealand play, you feel foolish if you tip the other team because they've got a 90% win record. So, you know, 9 times out of 10, they're going to win. So it's very, it's madness almost to say anyone but New Zealand. What I will say is, there's a vulnerability at the moment, I think. Three of their last 5 games, the 2 Springbok matches and England, teams that have been physical against them have got into them. And over the years, I've seen New Zealand, as we get towards the Northern Hemisphere winter and the tail end of their season, because I think of the size issue, the fact that they take a battering, they get slowed down by conditions, I think this is when they're most vulnerable. And Ireland weren't great against Argentina, but I know Joe Smith pretty well. And they would have thought, we can beat Argentina without giving anything away at all. And I think it's going to be... I thought it would be 3 points New Zealand at Twickenham. And if you think England are going to get within 3 points at Twickenham, then logic says you think Ireland, who are a better team than England at the moment, are going to beat them. So I'm going to go for Ireland in a really tight finish.
When you look at these two sides, they have the three ingredients of being number one and number two in the world. They have the consistency of selection. They've had pretty good team. They know who their teams are by and large. We talked a little bit about where Ireland's back five and maybe the midfield, and some of those positions in New Zealand is and so forth. They have a culture that they've built. Both obviously we know it's legendary in New Zealand, and I think that they've built a solid culture in Ireland. And I think it's the X's and O's of the game that Joe Schmidt and Hansen and Smith are just dynamic, and I can't wait to see that, as you said, Stuart, the tactical approach that both of these teams take. We take it for granted sometimes that it's a game plan that you come in with, and so the punch and the counterpunch that goes on, not just from the set piece, and the set piece for New Zealand is beyond just the scrums and the lineouts and the kickoffs. It's they train the counterattack as a set piece nowadays, right? And Ireland have kind of had that because of their Ga backgrounds and the Gaelic side of things, of that whole kind of dynamic. So it'll be a wonderful, wonderful spectacle, and I think that the feeling of each other out, knowing that this might be a semifinal, next year, in Japan, yeah, is going to be remarkable. And to the neutral like myself, can't wait to see it.
What was the last time Ireland played? Oh, no, the last time was when New Zealand beat them up after Chicago. But the time before, that was the Aaron Cruden re-kick, wasn't it, at the very end?
Yeah.
So, tight there.
I was going to ask about that last meeting because that one in 2013, New Zealand won it after the bell with that try. Then Ireland won in Chicago. And then you talk about the physicality side of it. Stuart, they came to the Aviva and were right on the very edge of the law and sometimes over it.
Well, I touched on it before. Their response to that defeat in Chicago was absolutely to be on the edge of legality, and they were over it.
Yeah.
To be perfectly honest, Ireland should have won. It should have been a penalty try from the scrummage, and the All Blacks should have had a man in the sin bin, and that would have been enough. So they almost beat them back to back, and were it was that. It's guile of sorts, isn't it?
It was a should have won three in a row. Yeah. So if you take the pundit, if you go down the high street away there, based upon form, fitness, outside of the history of legacy of 90%, Ireland is probably the favorite at home, which is, it's almost sacrosanct to say that.
And long-term weather forecasts, because we know what an effect it had on the weekend for England, is 12 degrees, sunny, a little bit of cloud. So it's going to be it would be nice for it to be an absolute test of, because there is, when it rains as hard as it did the weekend, the game is a certain type of game. Having the opportunity to have everything available to you will be fascinating to watch.
I mean, I'd love to see. McKenzie is a magician. I love the fact that New Zealand, they pick a guy to play fullback that a lot of Premiership clubs wouldn't offer a contract because they just say, you're all skin and bones, you're too small. And in many ways, he was their match winner. But it's like Hansen says, I'm going to have a short arse at fullback. Are you going to go away from the box kick where your defensive pattern comes up in a line and there's not much for us to do? Are you going to go after our fullback? And if your kicking is not right, we can hit you left or right. And kicking for Ireland against him will be Sexton. And you know that if Ireland are going to win it, Johnny Sexton is not just the lieutenant, he's the guy with one of the great tactical kicking boots in world rugby. So this whole tactical appreciation, what's going to happen there, I find fascinating.
I find the back line of Ireland, of these 6'2" to 6'4" from Sexton to Henshaw, comes back in potentially, Ringrose, Stockdale, Earls, obviously the little man, Kearney, McKenzie versus Kearney, it'd be an interesting battle, regards who's going to win the high ball there. But there's but their skill work, is unbelievable. So that in itself is a dynamic, because it's almost like two sets of forward packs, when it's phase play, and they're offloading, they're finding ways through one off tackles or two off tackles, and they're really able to keep the ball, so much more alive than most teams. So that's a really interesting dynamic as a forward. saying I'm more interested in the backs battle, you know, a lot of ways.
I know. I'm so proud of you, Dan.
He's a back row forward, though. He's not a complete forward.
Yeah, that's right.
This is the back row forward who would occasionally just American football pass the rugby ball halfway across the field. So it's in him.
I never met a back line I didn't like. I didn't say I never met a back I liked, but a back line.
What was interesting as well there, Paul said about 12 degrees, bit of cloud, good weather. Got to remember at Twickenham, New Zealand are an offload team, and the art of the offload is being right in the face of the defender but still having the skill to execute it, so the defence have got absolutely no time at all to readjust. And there's no doubt the weather really hampered New Zealand, and if they get that weather against Ireland, that will improve their game. And then you'll be looking at, can Ireland, with the way the game is being refereed and the high tackle status, can they get their choke tackle going in? Ireland love the double tackle. Mm. They will try that against New Zealand, but are people like James Ryan going to get away with it? There are so many things about this game. This could be the game of the year.
The one thing that happened in Chicago is, and you guys hit it on it earlier about with New Zealand and England, is that the kicking game by Ireland was superb. They turned New Zealand, and their kick chase was brilliant. And that's the point of the front foot versus back foot, you know, possession versus good possession, all of those type things that we talk about in general. They had a masterful class that day, even to the points like guys like Zeebo and others were just on the tackle or claiming balls and things like that. So I think that's always a factor in these two games. And you know, it'll be that ping pong battle or that aerial battle will be one to watch as well.
This is The Ruck, and we'll be back after this.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to The Ruck, and joining us on the line is Sarah Hunter, the captain of the England women's team, victorious England women's team, who launched their autumn campaign on Friday night with a 57-5 victory over the United States. Hello, Sarah. How are you doing?
Just about recovered from Friday night in the wet and the wind and the cold.
Yeah, you had miserable conditions just as the men's team did the following day. Talk us through the game. It was a pretty comprehensive 9-try victory over the United States.
Absolutely. I don't think it was ideal conditions for any rugby game, but if you're forward, it's not too bad. If you're back, they might think otherwise. But I don't think the scoreline reflects the nature of the physicality of the game itself. The USA a new team. They had a lot of caps last week against New Zealand, so similarly to us, they had a bit of inexperience to start with. And USA will always come out and they run hard, tackle hard, and they did that from minute one to minute 80. And unfortunately, things changed a little bit when they had a player sent off. But we as a team just tried to keep to our game plan in difficult conditions, was to try and impose ourselves on the USA and still play rugby, still try and play the game that we want and the things that we were trying to look and develop through this autumn international. And obviously there were six new caps getting their debut, and then obviously Katie Daly-McLean getting her 100th, so the spectrum really did differ, but there were some really positive things from the game and some things that we'll probably have to look to improve as we go on to Canada at the weekend.
We have to talk about Katie. A century of caps, a starring performance, 15 points, a runaway try that she scored. Just talk about how special a player she is. You know, not many players in English rugby have won 100 caps.
No, absolutely, yeah. And Katie is one of the best that there is around. I think to be a great international player, you've got to stay at the top of your game consistently, and Katie has done that for 10 years, over 10 years. Like, she got her first cap in 2007, so she's been instrumental all the way through that sort of reign that she's had. And as the years have gone on, she's had to adapt and change her game. And not only is she a great player, but she's a great leader. She's inspirational to those players around her. And I think it's a great feat that she went on to be the winning World Cup captain in 2014, then took a break to go and play seven. So she had a couple of years out and going off to be an Olympian and still come back and get 100 caps. And she deserved every minute of Friday night. And the way she played and pulled the strings just showed what a great player she is. And I'm sure she's got many more years to come as well.
We've been talking about co-captaincy and leadership and decision-making. And when we saw there were points in the men's game against the All Blacks where, you know, in hindsight, they might have made different calls. How does your relationship with Katie work in terms of making those big decisions, those game-changing calls in the heat of battle, where you have to try and read the situation in the cold light of day while still quite pumped up and perhaps kind of allowing the game to go with you? How do you converse with her? What's the dynamic like?
Yeah, I think it's a great question, and I think it's something that comes with time. So Katie and I have played for a long time. Like, when she was captain, I was vice captain, and vice versa. So I think you start to build a rapport up with a player, and you get a sense and feel during the game of knowing, like, and feel of when the team's on top and when it's the right time to really try and keep the foot on the throat and really go for that hammer blow, and is that kick to the corner and get some points through tries, or is it the moment in the game when actually we just need to look and take the points? And then obviously it's down to knowing, like with Katie, if it's that time in the game, she'll give me a nod and be like, yeah, this was in my range, like give me a shot at it, or actually no, we're gonna go to the corner. It obviously depends on how lineout's going. So you start to build as you develop into sort of these leadership roles. You start to get a build and feel of what the momentum of the game's like and what the right call is. And as a captain, and hindsight is such a wonderful thing. There's been times in my career I look back and gone, oh, if only I'd taken the 3 points, or actually, like, should we have taken the lineout? And when it comes off, it's a brilliant decision. When it doesn't, you look back and go, if only, similarly to the two penalty kicks that obviously Farrell went to the corner with. Those relationships, so I guess as the co-captaincy between Farrell and Hartley develops, I know Hartley wasn't on the field, but they'll start to get that instinct with one another.
Sarah, this week you're playing Canada. When you met them last year, you beat them 79-5. Can we expect more of the same?
Again, it's a bit of an unknown. There's one thing for sure, that they have brought a stronger squad than they did last autumn, and they're now in the country, so they've got rather than stepping off the plane and playing a day or two later, they've got sort of six days preparation to get over jet lag, get themselves together and prep for their first game against us. So I think it'll be another physical challenge. We've got one Delica Menin at a tighthead pot place here at Loughborough Lightning, so we know what's in store to come from her. And if the rest of her teammates play the way she's been playing all season, it's going to be an almighty battle. And we know that we can't underestimate Canada, because they've got a very good history and very, very good pedigree in women's rugby. And I think the last year they were bringing new players in to develop in their next World Cup cycle. So I think it could be a really exciting game. And we can't go into it with what happened last year. It's almost a fresh slate. Quite clean, because they will not want what happened last year to happen again. So I think we're going to have to improve from our game on Friday, and take it to another level and improve on areas, because we know Canada will come hard at us.
Great. Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us on The Ruck, Sarah. Good luck this week, and we look forward to catching up next week. Sam Warburton, Times and Sunday Times columnist, was saying on Sunday that Wales's win against Australia is very significant for that team, not because it'll have any necessary bearing on their game at the World Cup, other than the psychology of Wales knowing that they can win and Australia knowing that they can be beaten. It's been 10 years between drinks for Wales. How do you take that win?
10 years and 13 matches. There's a few journalist mates of mine who say, well, they've been so close that it's sort of irrelevant. That's not the truth. It's exact opposite. If you keep losing to a team and you lose by 2 or 3 points, the psychological concern is all the greater. And it was a monkey on the Welsh back, though I don't know what a monkey on a back actually looks like. But metaphorically, that had happened to Wales. And I think Sam Warburton, I think a lot of us felt that going into this game. I've been saying that about Wales Australia. It feels like about 5 years now, because they've been losing so regularly. They're in the same pool, though, of course, you know, in a World Cup, sometimes it doesn't hurt to lose a game at the pool stage, because you never know how it's going to break. But for Wales, it wasn't just beating Australia. It was also getting one over the Aussie-New Zealand axis. They've beaten South Africa a few times, beaten England, beaten France, beaten Ireland, but against those two, they've just been bereft. Year out from the World Cup, that wasn't a great game. The win is all-consuming and extremely important, and whilst it will not beat Australia in Japan a year from now, it will be in the heads of the Welshmen, and it will give them a far greater chance of winning, so hugely important.
Dan Bigger came on, Grayson, and kicked that winning penalty. It won't be a game that they'll sell many DVDs of, but there were... You know, they won it in the clutch moments, and Bigger has some critics, but he's a big game player, isn't he? I mean, how do you see their fly half situation?
It's one of those games, wasn't it, where Lee Halfpenny missed a couple of kicks and goal. You're like, so it was set up for Dan Bigger at the end to come on and deliver that. The penalties that Halfpenny missed, I would have lost a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so would a lot of it. But everybody's allowed a day off, but didn't hurt him in the end, because they've got he's a world-class competitor, Dan Bigger. He is absolutely... I get to see him a little bit with some of the stuff I do at Northampton. Yeah. Charming bloke, but his work ethic is absolutely up there with the best I've seen.
So Bigger had the Underhill moment, you know, that didn't happen. and that is psychologically important for this team. But Grace makes a point. The Wales have 3 or 4 guys that they want to pick at 10, and they got to figure out the 1/1.5, you know, that they want to play. Otherwise... It's a challenge to say, hey, I'm gonna play all 3 of you, 4 of you, Patchwell, Bigger, Priestland. Look at the teams, Premiership, Pro 14, internationally. If you don't consistently find some the people that you want to play in your team, and allow them to grow in confidence, gain the couple tools in their belt, play with the players with them, gain some leadership capacity, it's going to be really hard to win a game. And that's where Wales, you know, they pip a game, but you know, to get out of the quarterfinals, they've got to find somebody and say, that's our guy.
They'll be looking, I think, for Bigger to come through from Northampton. Gareth Anscombe is fantastic, I think, coming off the bench when you've got a broken field. He's really good at that. Patchell is an excellent player, but there is doubt in Wales about his mental strength now and again. And Bigger to me comes somewhere in between the two of them. And as Paul said, he's very dependable. You know, you think back to the last World Cup, what he did against England. I would be quite surprised that going into the Six Nations, Bigger's not the starting 10 and going through to Japan, I would think, Paul.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And and like I say, he's Northampton being where they are, their game is developing,
yeah.
And his game is going to develop within it.
Yeah, because they're
playing. Yeah, because they are playing a progressive brand of rugby, which is going to take some time to work. That will enhance him all the more because it gives him a little bit of a different look to the things that he's been used to over the years at the Ospreys and with Wales.
Dan, we can't talk about match-winning moments without mentioning Will Hooley, whose late penalty goal won the game for the USA against Samoa.
Whatever the coverage was, he had literally missed a chip shot with, you know, just a few minutes beforehand. He'd slipped and fallen over and just pushed one that was, you know, an absolute sitter. And then to hit one from, you know, close to 40, you know, in between your 5 and 15 from the right side. I think we had five times we played them and all were within a try, you know, in the past. And so it's been a moment of first for the U.S. this year. They're 9-0 in test matches, you know, lost against Maori last week in Chicago, New Zealand Maori, but probably, you know, Reg 9, there was 8 or 9, 10 guys that were missing. So, you know, Gary Gold has come in. Dave Hodges, formerly of Clonethly, yeah. and U.S. Is the GM. You know, that combined with Major League Rugby, which had its first year, will be going into a second year from 7 teams to 9 professional teams in America, has given guys some consistent playing times, the ability to kind of gain some level of fitness, gain some level of skill acquisition, play within team environments at a couple of notches above where they've played before. And we've got about 24 guys playing abroad now. It's kind of the reverse of what Canada was when I was playing, and so forth, which kind of is the reverse model. So the U.S. has got a real opportunity to play Romania this week in Romania, so which is always a bogey for us. But I think coming out of that and then playing Ireland, you know, the last game, that's without arguably their best 9, who was not there, Sean Davies, who got injured against Maori. AJ McGinty is out injured right now. Samu Manoa was out, maybe back this week, and a couple of other guys. So, you know, depth is a rare commodity in all of rugby, let alone for America. And that all those things combined, it was a great win. San Sebastian, by all accounts, looked like they hosted a wonderful game.
You can't have a bad game
you
from San Sebastian, can you?
Yeah, absolutely.
So it was 30-29.
That's right.
To the USA.
Yeah, the last kick on the last whistle. Yeah.
Which bizarrely on the TV coverage was only showing 75 minutes on the game clock, because that obviously didn't match up with the match clock. So anybody who was watching it thought there was 5 minutes to go, but actually all the players on the ground knew that.
Not as many people can have the production value of the Ruck, the podcast. You know,
so does Will Hooley get your God of the Week award? We have to go into our regular feature now. Do you have a God or Goddess nomination?
Yeah, I mean, I usually talk a little bit too much, but I'm super pleased because I haven't mentioned it for Sam Underhill for Bath. Dan Levy came on for Ireland, and I'm looking forward to that, and so forth. And Strauss, I was up at the Scotland Fiji match. It came on, and you know, him to play against South Africa, you know, is going to be really interesting. But I've got to stick with Will. Will's a wonderful person as well. He's a great guy off the field, and he's doing some his education and doing a lot of things playing for Bedford. So I'm really excited that he was able to do that.
Stuart,
Bigger's the one that springs to mind. It breaks the Welsh voodoo, but sometimes your gods, they don't have to be winners. They don't have to be winners. The great ones have those flaws. And England lost the game, but I thought Underhill was magnificent. 7 has been the hole in England for a long time. Let's not get carried away too early, but there were clear signs that here is a bloke who can stop England patching up the 7 position with a bad deal, trying to get X6s in 7. They could have the genuine real deal. He's got to get there very quickly now, but he's my God of the Week, Sam Underhill.
God of the Week was going to be the God of Rugby because of the proliferation of 45, 43s. And you start to think, where's the game going? Give me a good old 9-6. Well, Wales gave us a good old 9-6. That's won by it was a test match where, built on their defence, the God of Rugby made Will Hooley fall over with a 2-foot tap in. I do some coaching with Will, And that's one of those where you just hang your head because the pitch gave way underneath him and then he got the opportunity. The script was written for him to kick that goal, to create that. He made the weather change in England from a 50% chance of rain to a 100% deluge for the whole game to create an extraordinary afternoon. All of that doesn't win the God of Rugby, God of the Week. Mine is the goddess that is Katie Daly-McLean winning a 100th cap in an MVP performance. Anybody who can play Test Rugby for 100 games and be part of a trailblazing generation. So she's my goddess of the week.
Gents, thank you very much for coming in. We've got another big build-up week before, as Stuart described it, the biggest game of the year, Ireland-New Zealand. And we'll be back this time next week to pick the bones out of that. So thank you all very much.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.